Hello, and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me a bit later today will be Peter Salmon, and we are entering, I think, the third week of this lockdown quarantine version of the show. It has been going pretty good so far. It's getting easier, a bit easier to produce, I think, and hopefully we won't have to do it too much longer. I'm not in charge of that, of course, but for the most part, I've been still enjoying the show and doing the show, and I hope you've all been enjoying listening to the show still, and we will proceed as semi-normal or as semi-normally as we possibly can. Anyway, End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new Jane Austen adaptation, Emma. That is in the back half of the show. For the first half, though, we're going to do one of these lists that I've been doing to kick off the show, as we have for the last few weeks. This week, this is a list I've sort of had in the back of my head and in one of my notebooks for a while, because it's, you know, it's almost the start of, well, what was going to be summer movie season, where all these big Hollywood movies come out, so on and so forth, and that looks like it's probably not going to happen. If you remember from a couple of weeks ago, I did that show about all the release dates that have been moved since COVID-19, and basically summer movie season doesn't start till August. August 14th, when Wonder Woman 1984 comes out, which is typically about the point where the summer movie season ends. And in fact, last year, we took a break for the last 3 weeks of August because there was just nothing good coming out. So we took a summer vacation, but it seems like this year we may have already taken our summer vacation a couple of weeks ago when we were trying to reorientate the show to do it during COVID. So for this week's list, the list of the week, I'm going to talk about the 10 summer movies that bombed but really should have been hits anyway. So I'm going to start off with something fairly recent, came out in 2016 actually. It's called Popstar Don't Stop Never Stopping, and it is from the fellas who did all the Lonely Island videos on Saturday Night Live. It's directed by Jorma Taccone and Akiva Schaffer, and starring, of course, Andy Samberg. It's kind of like their second, I don't know if it's their second, but it's like maybe definitely the second big screen project that that team worked on, the first one being Hot Rod, which is I think pretty solidly funny, still a really good time. Dopey as heck, but it's still a lot of fun, and you know, those guys definitely have good chemistry and definitely know what it takes to make each other crack up and make the audience crack up. Popstar is no exception. It's this kind of music mockumentary. I'm not going to say it's the 21st century version of Spinal Tap, but I will reserve judgment to be the first one to be able to say that, if I have been the first one to say that anyway. So it's Andy Samberg as this former boy band member who's, you know, struck out on his own, and, you know, it's all the selfishness and pettiness and stuff that goes on in the music industry. The music is a lot of fun. The cameos, there are so many great cameos. There's like Justin Bieber cameos in it, both surviving Beatles cameo, Katy Perry cameos, Akon, the RZA, Snoop Dogg, Usher, who am I forgetting? Like, there's a ton. Weird Al Yankovic even has a cameo in it. So, it's a lot of fun. Very, very funny. If you like the Lonely Island style gags, like the video shorts on Saturday Night Live, this is definitely in that wheelhouse. I think it's definitely worth checking out, and I think it's ripe for rediscovery. As a lot of sort of really great comedies, like Spinal Tap, sort of ripe for rediscovery years later. Number 9. This is an off-kilter pick, but I will stand by it. The Village, which is the M. Night Shyamalan film from 2004. I think if you look at the film without judging the quote-unquote twist, because the twist you can see coming a mile away, it's a fascinating film in terms of its look, in terms of its style. There's real dread in places. Really great, you know, introductory performance by Bryce Dallas Howard. But the entire cast is great. You got Adrian Brody, Joaquin Phoenix, William Hurt, Sigourney Weaver, Cherry Jones. Just a really great cast, really well designed, as you'd expect from a Shyamalan film. He expends so much effort trying to meticulously lay out this twist that is so obvious, and it doesn't help that he cameos in the key moment in the twist. This was Shyamalan in kind of full-fledged egocentric mode. That would eventually carry him through to Lady in the Water, which is like him at his most hubristic. I think The Village, if you ignore that part of it, in from like design, from acting, from like editing, plot, momentum, music, it is a really solid film that deserves to be revisited. So number 8 is Idiocracy. So people may know the name, may not have actually seen the movie. When you hear the story of Idiocracy, in terms of, like, it was made by 20th Century Fox, which is the same studio that made Mike Judge's other film, Office Space, which was a big cult hit. But Idiocracy was, like, unceremoniously dumped on the weekend before Labor Day. There was no press, there was no preview screenings, there was no screenings for critics, none of that. And it's hard to find a movie that may be like sort of more prescient from the modern political age than Idiocracy. It's heavily quoted, heavily memed. It sort of took 10 years for this movie to come to fruition, even though it's like set in like the 26th century, but still 10 years after its first release, it finally kind of finds its moment. A lot of cult comedies are like that, of course, but it's weird that, you know, Idiocracy kind of hits so many things like directly on the nose, and it's really interesting to go back and rewatch it now and pick up on some of that stuff. Another one that also feels kind of prescient, Gremlins 2, The New Batch. It's much more meta than the original Gremlins. It's more winky and knowy. I think that, you know, if it was sort of like released now as a reboot, or like a reimagining or a requel of the original Gremlins, I think a lot of people would talk about how really smart it is, and how it's really got its finger on the culture and the buzz. And unfortunately, this was like 30 years too early. But Gremlins 2, The New Batch, I think might be a better film than the original Gremlins. That might be sacrilege, but it certainly has much more fun with the concept, like with Gizmo, like working out, watching Rambo, and all the various like variations on the gremlin creatures, the scientist one, the lady gremlin, the gremlin with wings. It has a lot of interesting fun with the concept, and John Glover as kind of like this Trumpian Steve Jobs kind of megalomaniac business developer. Really great performance from him, although he's excellent in everything. But I will stand by, I think I'll stand by it, that Gremlins 2 might be better than the original. Number 6, Speed Racer, which is the Wachowskis' follow-up to the Matrix movies, if you don't count V for Vendetta. That's like one of those situations where, did they direct it or didn't they direct it? Anyway, Speed Racer is a rarity in that it's able to capture the feeling and the vibe of the original anime show, which is like so hard, like the styles between like what's Japanese anime and American live action film. It's oil and water, but somehow the Wachowskis were able to excuse me, able to bring both together and sort of were able to reconcile them, them being American filmmakers taking that Japanese art form and reinterpreting it for an American audience so that it feels very similar, but at the same time, it's kind of its own thing. It kind of stands on its own. There's so much light, there's so much color. It's almost an antithesis of those Matrix movies, so the second two Matrix movies. It might have been galling at the time. I think people were kind of genuinely shocked that this was a work of the Wachowskis. But again, I think revisiting it years later, you kind of appreciate the attention to detail and the skill and the filmmaking craft, let's say. Number five, I have an oldie, The Wizard of Oz, which came out in August 1939. It was critically successful, but it bombed. It was kind of big budget. It was $3 million, which was a lot of money. It was like, that was Titanic size money in 1939 dollars. And it did not make that money back. And of course, there were all these problems with, you know, like makeup tests. Margaret Hamilton like had dyed herself green by the time the movie was over. The original actor was going to play the Tin Man, had like, you know, went to the hospital because the silver paint affected him. It was like kind of the first really big example of big sustained use of color film in a movie too, which you know, technically had its issues. Not in the film itself, but just like the cost and the expense. There was just so much money going out the door, so many problems as the film was being produced. And then it bombs, and it doesn't end up back on the radar until 1956, when CBS put it on TV for the first time, and everyone was like, oh my goodness, Wizard of Oz. And now it's a classic, and now it's one of the classics. Like, how many best movies of all time lists has that ever been on? So it's strange how this happens. And, you know, another great example of this too, although it wasn't released in the summer, was It's a Wonderful Life. That bombed in 1947 when it came out just before Christmas. Of course, that also got new life on TV in the years afterward. Number four I have here is Out of Sight, which is a Steven Soderbergh movie in honor of Vince, maybe. But no, I remember when this came out. It came out in the summer of 98, and it was like sandwiched between like Godzilla and Armageddon and Deep Impact and all these like big, loud, dumb movies, and this simple and elegant sort of Elmore Leonard adaptation kind of gets lost in the shuffle, even though it stars George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez, who are so great together. They have such great chemistry together. Great supporting cast too. You have Ving Rhames, Don Cheadle, late great Dennis Farina. Everybody is so great. It's so sexy, it's funny, but it's also kind of disturbing in places. There's a scene where Don Cheadle Snoopy gets payback on a rival drug dealer, and it's kind of in, you don't see the violence, but you see the reaction to the violence in one of the characters, and it's kind of harrowing. It really is worth revisiting. It is such a great movie, and I enjoy it a lot in terms of like romantic movies. It's not really a romantic movie, but I think it's probably one of the most romantic movies I've seen, or at least a romantic movie I've enjoyed. Number three is The Iron Giant, which was Brad Bird's first movie. He, of course, went on to do The Incredibles and Ratatouille and Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol and Tomorrowland. But this is the one that kind of got him started, and it's kind of famous for being a really great movie no one went to see. Sadly, it came out in 1999. I can't remember if it was on my list for the best of 99, but it definitely is worthy of a place. It's this really great story about a robot who comes to Earth, befriends a boy. He's kind of a a peaceful robot. He doesn't like war. He has like this visceral reaction to whenever there's like maybe imminent violence. And of course that's grossly misunderstood. It's the, you know, it takes place during the Cold War in the 1950s. So people don't necessarily see the alien robot as anything other than a threat. It's kind of Frankenstein-y in that way. It kind of has an ET vibe. But it's really well acted, well designed. It is a beautiful film. One of the last great examples of cel animation, sadly, the old, you know, hand-drawn art form. Although, interestingly, the Iron Giant himself, I believe, was a CG creation. They did him on the computer. Everything else was hand-drawn, though. And like I said, it is one of the kind of the last great examples of that. Yeah, they still made hand-drawn animated films for a couple of years after that, but I don't think any of them stepped up in the way Iron Giant did. So number two, Ridley Scott followed up Alien with Blade Runner, and that is number two. Blade Runner, of course, famously bombed, famously was taken out of Ridley Scott's hand and reworked, and included this narration that nobody really liked. And then it comes out VHS a couple of years later. They release the director's cut, and that kind of gets the ball rolling with this kind of cult feedback that came out of Blade Runner. Of course, it's easy to understand why. There's really nothing quite like Blade Runner. It's got Harrison Ford. It's Harrison Ford in sci-fi, which of course people liked in Star Wars and Indiana Jones and stuff. But of course, this is much more adult, much more introspective. People really didn't get it. Like, all the ingredients were there, but then people went and saw Blade Runner, like, we don't, like, maybe not this, which is too bad. It's endlessly fascinating. So many interesting characters. Rutger Hauer as Beatty. It's so many great scenes. The composition of it, the world building, the flying cars, the noodles, the holograms, all of that, and something of a minor miracle that there was a sequel 30 years later that managed to not disrespect the original. And I think that's a really kind of a testament to the world that Ridley Scott built and the wide-ranging influence that the film had, that people were able to tune in on its wavelength and were able to reinterpret it. I mean, not to say that anyone could have done what Denis Villeneuve did, but I think there's something very particular about Blade Runner that, you know, for everyone who gets it, they really get it. Maybe I'm, you know, spinning my tires here because we're getting close to the end. Yeah, so number one, a movie I always like to talk about, Scott Pilgrim versus the World. I have no idea why this movie wasn't a bigger hit in 2010. It's funny. It's got cool action. It's got fun effects. It's got great music. A ton of people who would go on to be so big, like Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Brie Larson, Chris Evans, Aubrey Plaza, even Brendan Routh, who, I mean, by that, he had done Superman Returns, but, you know, in terms of re-establishing him as, like, a comedic actor and being able to sort of escape that Superman curse, so much talent on display. And the first fight at the Battle of the Bands is perfect. I think it's perfect. It's got so many jokes, so many zingers, so many sight gags. It is a wonder. You know, it's about 5 minutes, but it's like a really perfect 5 minutes. And I enjoyed, I always, even if I just have it on in the background, I always just kind of stop and watch that scene from beginning to end, because it works on so many different levels. It's, you know, with the back and forth with the characters, the different gags, the over the top of the first evil ex. He's just, you know, the way he says, yeah, people ask if he's dressed as a pirate, and he's like, well, pirates are in this year. It's just so great. I love the back and forth in that scene. And I'm not sure the film ever reaches those heights again. The one where Chris Evans plays the evil ex, that scene at Casa Loma with the skateboarding contest, gets close, but I think that first battle with the first evil ex is damn near perfect. But I will have to leave that there and cue up the music and cue up our review of Emma and get Peter on the line. We'll be back in a sec. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. And every day Emma would go out searching for that play that never, ever came her way. You know, sometimes she'd come home so depressed. I'd hear her crying in the back room, feel so distressed. And I'd remember back when she was five, to the words that used to make Emmeline come alive. It was Emmeline. Emma, Emmeline, I'm gonna write your name high on that silver screen.
Thank you for your kindness to Harriet.
He was unpardonably rude, and he aimed at wounding more than Harriet.
I was completely mistaken in Mr. Elton. There is a littleness about him which you discovered and I did not.
You would have chosen for him better than he has chosen for himself. Harriet Smith has some first-rate qualities which Mrs. Elton is totally without. She does you credit, Emma, as you do her.
Ah, I'm sure.
Come, set your companions an example. They're all lazy. They're all asleep! You must dance another set!
I am ready whenever I am wanted.
With whom will you dance?
With you. If you will ask me. You have shown that you can dance, and we are not really so much brother and sisters to make it improper.
No, indeed.
And that was a clip from Emma. It's the new film from Autumn de Wilde, and it stars Anya Taylor-Joy, Johnny Flynn, Mia Goth, Miranda Hart, Josh O'Connor, Callum Turner, Amber Anderson, and Bill Nighy.
Joining me on the line now is Peter Wesley Salmon. I had to do all three names, like we are living in Victorian England. How are you doing, Peter?
Oh, I'm doing good, doing good. Just living life during this quarantine. Yeah. Picked up on reality shows.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, didn't I see you?
Yeah.
Well,
what was that one called that came out the other day? It was gold.
Was that the Hot and Bothered?
The too Hot to Handle or something?
Too Hot to Handle, that's right.
Yeah. But I've been watching some reality shows that I was glad to get down into, what we're going to review.
All right. We are here to review this week Emma, which is the new adaptation of the Jane Austen, the classic Jane Austen story. Probably the second best. Well, maybe is it second or third best? Because you say, ask someone to name three Jane Austen books. It's Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility, and Emma, probably. Anyway, leaving that debate aside, this was your selection, Peter. You wanted to review Emma. And I want to give you a chance to just say why you wanted to review it this week with your turn and what it was about Emma that spoke to you.
Yeah. There wasn't really much else going on. We had planned that one about the cripple camp, but that was its name. I'm not. But I was a little disappointed. I apologize, Mr. Barack and Michelle. But I was a little disappointed. So I don't know. Emma was the only thing that really popped out to me because the Brad Pitt one you had already done and a few others. And I've been keeping that up to date with docs or Netflix films. So other than the Ed Helms one. But, I'm okay we didn't review that one. And my parents had seen Emma back. It was their last film to see in theaters before this, whole jazz. And they liked it, or at least, thought I might like it. And I love that Johnny Flynn. Scroll to Recall is one of my favorites, and he's, you know, he's great and everything. So he caught my attention as well. And Anya Taylor-Joy, she's cool. And I only knew her back in the day because of LaBeouf, but Mia Goth, I enjoyed her presence as well. So yeah, I think it's just it being really the only one I could think of, but also, you know, it having some standouts that caught my attention. Yeah, that's why I picked good old Emma. I don't usually love, like, I don't love Jane Austen, but I'm okay with period pieces in this Georgian Regal era, you know? Yeah, it was nice.
I want to rewind just for a sec. Scrotal Recall?
Love, whatever it's called. Do you not know what I'm talking about? Scrotal Recall?
No, no. Well,
I forget what it's called now. Lovesick. Lovesick.
Okay.
Sick. The first season was Scrotal Recall, but then they changed it.
Okay.
Yeah, it was, understandably they changed it, but it was, yeah, I still call it that. Because it really goes more towards the themes of it.
Okay.
Yeah. But even that name, it's like a high quality, like British show. E4 vibes, like Skins and such. And I really enjoyed it.
Okay.
Yeah. And he's the guy, he's going to play, Johnny Flynn's going to play David Bowie in upcoming Stardust.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
I can see that, actually. He has like an unconventional look that I think... That Bowie had, you know, that it's not like square jaw. It's like, you know, he has the high cheekbones and the protruding jaw, and he has the otherworldly look, you know, that would make a good Ziggy Stardust. Yeah, yeah, I can see that. I can see that.
Oh yeah, and it's the hunky dory period too, where his hair was a lot longer, and it, yeah, he really. I saw the trailer, and he really fits in. Yeah, and like I said, Anya Taylor-Joy, she's Guardians of the Galaxy, right? Batista's kind of love interest?
In Guardians of the Galaxy?
Yeah. No?
I don't... No, she's the witch, and, Split, and...
Okay.
Guardians of the Galaxy!
Yeah, I have no idea who I was thinking about then, but,
Were you thinking about Pom Klemmerdorf?
Maybe
who plays Mantis?
Like the one kind of alien that dates not dates Batista, like she finds Batista ugly, but like
yeah,
they have some flirt things.
Yeah, Mantis. You're thinking about Mantis, who's a Pom Klemperoff. Although it should be noted, Anya Taylor-Joy is going to be in a comic book movie that's supposed to come out at some point. She's I think she plays Magic in New Mutants, which is supposed to come out at some point. I mean, it's been on the shelf for 3 years, I want to say.
Yeah, Maisie Williams looks like season 3 or 4 Arya Stark.
Yeah, she plays Wolfsbane in it. I can't remember their real character names. I remember their code names from New Mutants. It's not like it's not going to be like a real kind of X-Men-y movie with like the outfits and everything, but it's based on the X-Men comic, The New Mutants. So, yeah, it's interesting to see Anya Taylor-Joy in this playing Emma, because it's not about her like dealing with scary things or you know running away from monsters or possessed goats or whatever the witch was about. It's so it was fun to see her play. Well, I guess maybe against type. She's not, you know, she's played the final girl. She's not the final girl in this. I was interested to see if she was up to the challenge of
being able to do a period piece in comparison to her previous work.
Well, the witch is a period piece. It takes place in like the 16th century or something.
Okay, yeah. Then what was your hesitance?
No, I wasn't hesitant. I was just you know, could she do? I mean, Emma's kind of a romantic comedy. It's kind of. Again, she's not running from monsters. Emma, it's funny how the movie starts with a quote, right, directly from the book, like, Emma Woodhouse lived 21 years without much that disturbed or vexed her.
I like that quote. That's one for the book, and it's just a perfect description needed for the, you know, Anya Taylor's character, good old Emma.
Yeah. Right, and so, you know, she's always kind of playing characters who are disturbed or vexed. So, like, could she capture that lightheartedness? Could she be the center of all this, like, romance and love and flirtatiousness? And she was. I think she was pretty solid.
I think she did a good job.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it would be harder for her if it wasn't Emma, because Emma is very different than a lot of the other females in that era. She's a little eccentric, so I think Anya Taylor was able to add, you know, some of that pizzazz to Emma, based on, you know, the characters that you said she's in previous works. I thought probably for me the most standout thing for Emma was the cast, the actual acting. Bill Nighy. He's a British friend of mine. I loved him, Mr. Woodhouse. A lot of questions. Like, you know, what is he sick? Like, what's the situation? Is he a little, you know, spaced out? He's very eccentric too, and he left a lot to our imagination. You know, that I think helped explain too why Emma's maybe, you know, a little different, because her dad is too, and that's a strong part of the book too. With him also, you know, more as like a side character, but strong for. How Emma's viewed. So yeah, I thought Bill Nighy did great, and yeah, everybody. Maya Goth too. She was a standout, I thought. Mm-hmm. Her character, Harriet Smith, smartest of them all. I don't know. She was wise. She was wise. And like I said, Johnny Flynn, he's my jam. So I thought he did great. And I thought his costume design was the best out of all of them. I loved his collars. The collars he was popping. Like, I don't think there's a single scene where you see his neck. His collars are high up. It was looking good. You know? It's spot on to that period.
I did enjoy the scene where, at the beginning, where you see him getting dressed. Because in these films, you always... you know, maybe this comes from Autumn, what the director's name? Autumn de Wilde. I forgot it for a sec. You know, maybe this comes from having a female perspective too, that you see these period pieces, and there's always a scene where you see the lady get prepared, and usually involves stuffing herself in a corset and getting that all tied up.
But this note is the guys, starts with the guys in this one.
Yeah, and that's, you know, really interesting that, you know, for the men, everything is, like, just as elaborate with, like, the tights and the shirt and the, you know, being sewn into the pants, pretty much. It's kind of crazy, and so I did appreciate that attention to detail.
Yeah, Jane Austen didn't help with class issues, if anything, made them maybe, not a pinch of words, but she didn't help with class issues, but she helped a tremendous amount with female roles in works and just, you know, female roles in England and the world altogether. And I think they kept that feeling going in Emma with what you were saying, you know, Johnny Flynn being one of the first ones to dress up, you know? But since we talked about them dressing up, I was a little disappointed with the costume design in this. What are your thoughts on the costume design?
I like the costume design, actually. I like the, it's kind of, like, purposefully unfamiliar, and, you know, I don't know a lot about, you know, how people dressed in this time period, except from what I've seen in, like, past movies that take place in this time, but it almost seems, like, purposefully...
It was a little too in my face,
It felt off-kilter.
Yeah, it felt off kilter, and a little too in my face. Just so many bright colors, a lot of shiny colors, and a lot of the ones that really contrast each other in not an enjoyable way. And I find so many distinct costumes in one scene that none really stood out for me. And it could just be because we watched Portrait of a Lady on Fire, and before that I watched Phantom Thread, so I'm more used to... a better costume design. I think also too much of what they were wearing was shiny, and I don't. That's like a plastic thing. It's like a, you know, a plastic cotton sort of thing. You know, and back in the era, there would have been bright colors and such, but more of a solid appearance as opposed to, I don't know, a little shiny, or it was just too in your face. Even the bright colors back in the period were more subtle. You know, I would have preferred if, like, I would have been okay with the colors if it was more of a kind of technicolor aura to it, but it was too much brightness. It was getting in my face, and it was pulling away from the period vibes. Yeah, but you said you liked the costumes.
Yeah, I get what you're saying about the it's very ostentatious. pun intended. But I think with the Portrait of a Lady on Fire, you know, they're not in society. They're on this island all by themselves, so they don't have to dress up because, of course, and you know, it's all about appearances. It's all about looking like your money, and you know, the grand expectations of society, even in like a small village like this. So in Portrait of a Lady on Fire, they can dress down, and it's not such a big thing because they're just a couple of women on their own on an island somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, but I thought in the scenes there was maybe too much in every scene, like too much in the background and such, so it took a bit of a focus away from me on the characters.
Mm-hmm.
But I think also for like a lot of people, it was good. Maybe those colors and visual issues I didn't like will be what, you know, pull people in or maybe make them enjoy it. So
I think that's the photographer though in Autumn de Wilde, because this is like her first movie as a director. She's done like photography and she's done a few music videos. So like, I think she brings very much a photographer's ideas about like staging and about set decoration and about having those like wild details and things to catch your eye. Everything is really perfectly set up, and there's a lot of really great cinematography, especially in the summer scenes, where everything just feels so warm and perfect.
The outside shots were really gorgeous. The ones who are walking on that little road with all the hills in the background. Well, not really hills, just flat, beautiful green.
Right, and that's the photographer in the director coming through. Is you have everything in the image arranged just so. And what I found about the costumes is, I mean, that's kind of an expression of that too. Is like there's a scene where the Mia Goth character Harriet is, you know, she's kissing the man who she's become engaged to, and you know, he's got this like stovepipe hat on, she has this bonnet, and there's this weird negotiation, like, how do we kiss with our weird hats on?
I enjoyed theirs very much. So I think maybe it's just, yeah, it was super bright colors. I don't know, it took my attention away, whereas, you know, she was still like, she wasn't like lower class, but hers were more plain clothing, and I think I enjoyed that more. And I loved, I loved the guy that she got married. He's really awesome. Sex Education. I forget his name, but he's great. He didn't really have any lines, but her and his story was fun. Their conclusion, I think, was the one I was happiest with.
You mean the show Sex Education, not that there was sex education in the movie.
Well, heck, no, there definitely wasn't back then. There should have been. He's in Sex Education. Yeah, and so was the priest who he ended up marrying, like the one who made the painting.
Right, yes. Yeah.
Mr. Elton.
Mr. Elton.
One thing I will say about the costumes that I did a bit of research in, there's a couple of scenes where you see a bunch of women walking in a line, and they're all wearing their red cloaks, and you get like these very strong Handmaid's Tale vibe.
That's what I made numerous comments about that while watching it. Their hats were a little different.
The hats were different, but the cloaks were very much in that vibe. And I, you know, when they filmed this, it was I guess sometime early last year. So like Handmaid's Tale had been out, and at least one season of Handmaid's Tale had been out. So someone had to be thinking about like drawing some kind of commentary about, you know, these scenes where you see a bunch of women in red cloaks walking in a line. The historical thing about that too, though, is that actually red was a very common color for women's cloaks. And there's a story about like French soldiers like coming ashore in Wales, because, you know, thinking that they're going to confront British soldiers, redcoats, but they end up getting captured by women because they were wearing these red cloaks and they were caught off guard. And so it's you know, red was a very easy, very vibrant color to wear. So I you know, on the one hand, it's very historically accurate, but on the other hand, there is there again, and with DeWild being a photographer, I don't think anything is by accident. I'm just not entirely sure what kind of commentary she's trying to say.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I guess that Handmaid's Tale is kind of showing that, you know, female issue, and she's just kind of showing that, yeah, of course there was female issues back in this day, you know, even when Jane Austen's work, you know, the main characters and things people love focused on females, there was still like today some awful things almost, you know, in comparison to Handmaid's Tale. I'm also curious if Margaret Atwood maybe based the what they wear off of you know, the previous wear, like back in the day. Like she's got like a Bachelor of Arts, right? She probably had to read about it. I had to read about those red cloak people once, so it wouldn't surprise me if I've read Handmaid's Tale and she did in-depth description of it, so it wouldn't surprise me if she took it from historical usage. But this Autumn de Wilde would be more so a reference to Margaret Atwood. It's just Jane Austen. I think, you know, there's got to be some comments about feminism, or, you know, sprinkled about, and that was a subtle way that fit into the period. I totally forgot that people actually did wear the red. That's cool. I don't love it, so I'm okay it's not that hip currently.
Well, I would be concerned if there were women wandering around wearing red cloaks, and in a way, otherwise,
I think Kim Kardashian would disagree with you there, but okay.
Well, there is, you know, the irony factor, of course, with Handmaid's Tale. You go to downtown Cambridge, I mean, when we're not on quarantine, you go to downtown Cambridge, there are women who walk around in red cloaks, sort of leading these guided tours of all the places in Cambridge where they shoot Handmaid's Tale. It's a little cottage industry there.
I forgot about that, in Hamilton, too.
Yeah, well, anywhere where they really kind of shoot, but, you know, predominantly, you know, in Cambridge and Hamilton, where they do a lot of the exteriors. I like this a lot. The movie, I mean, I've never been a big Jane Austen nerd.
I'm not a huge fan. I don't like Pride and Prejudice and such. And my partner has an English degree and getting her master's, and she hates that Jane Austen. Jane Austen's got a lot of flaws. And she, like I said before, she doesn't help with class issues, you know? But they're period pieces. They're an amazing look at what history was like back then, with the focus upon females, even though the rich, or middle, like there's the one, right? Mia Goth's character, Harriet. I would say if you don't like Jane Austen, maybe don't. Well, no, I don't. I liked it. But I just want to let people know this is Jane Austen, and there is some Jane Austen vibes throughout it. So if you absolutely hate Jane Austen, maybe don't see it.
What's interesting, though, is I was looking through some online commentary, and the people who are familiar with the book and like the book don't necessarily like this adaptation of it. So I'm curious if maybe there's something appealing in this adaptation for people who may not be familiar with the source material. I mean, that would require maybe something on the equivalent of some kind of polling or study or something. But I just anecdotally, I noticed that people are like, I love the book. I was kind of lukewarm on this. It does sort of, and to the credit of the film, it does not feel like other Jane Austen adaptations, like the Pride and Prejudice miniseries that people still love from the 90s that had Colin Firth and I can't remember her name. But like that is very much like in the mold of like masterpiece theater, and it treats it the material in a kind of a very kind of sacred way, where it's like we have to stage it as is, and this is my thing with adaptations, is an adaptation kind of has to stand on its own. If you've read the book and you want to kind of see the movie, that's great, but an adaptation I think has to stand without any prior knowledge. Without any prior knowledge of the book, like you have to treat this like it's like somebody wrote a script for this, that it wasn't based on anything, because I can think of examples where, you know, you have to go into a film like having read the book. Like things like the Harry Potter movies don't make a lick of sense if you've never read the Harry Potter books, because
they skip over the details of things that...
Did you not read the books?
No, I read the books. Okay. I read all the books, and that's how I know is, like, I can... Like, the whole climax in Prisoner of Azkaban, where, you know, they're all confronting Wormtail and the Gary, I can't remember all their names, Sirius Black, but like we're all like the relationships between like the friends in the past is like revealed. That goes by so quickly in Prisoner of Azkaban. You get whiplash if you hadn't read that portion of the book, because that portion of the book is like 50 pages long, but it's like 5 pages long in the script.
Yep.
But
like you said, she added some modern pizzazz and enough in this. Yeah, you don't have to have read Emma,
right?
Like at all. I didn't read Emma.
You say that like you deserve a trophy.
What are you gonna do? No, I don't. No, but
I
I just want to say I loved my favorite part. I think what I paid the most attention to was Emma and George's relationship is very fun. Is a fun little roller coaster, and they give each other little jabs, and they really evidently were best friends, and yeah, I don't know, I just thought it was really well done. I thought it was what stands out the most to me, I think, when it comes to the acting and the good old back and forth. Yeah, they gave each other a lot of jabs, like little cute jabs, you know?
Because I didn't feel that worked terribly well. I don't think it was necessarily the actor's fault, but there was some kind of I get the feeling that relationship is sort of deeper than how it feels on film. And I understood that. I knew enough about Emma that I understood, like, they're, and I also understand it from Clueless, because Clueless is loosely based on
Emma. I was waiting to see if you'd bring it up. Johnny Flynn, he was no Paul Rudd.
He was no Paul Rudd.
Which is a very damning thing you want to hear in a review. About the wedding scene in Clueless, where they, Reese and Paula, yeah.
Right. Well, you mean Alicia.
What?
You mean Alicia. Alicia
Who
Silverstone.
Did I say?
You said Reese.
Ooh, yeah, Alicia Silverstone, sorry.
That was a little slip, but no, so, yeah, I understood that relationship was a bit deeper, and I didn't quite feel that. There are some scenes where you can sort of feel... I don't think it's subtle. I don't think that, again, Autumn de Winter being a photographer isn't necessarily used to dealing with subjects in motion, and maybe that's a legitimate criticism in the film. Like, well, sort of when the actors all individually on their own are doing good, but there are times when the interactions don't seem to gel, but you know, there is a little empty, and I mean, but there are times, and you know, the scene where Mr. Knightley proposes to Emma, like that, I found that actually pretty good.
Me too. Yeah. Underneath the tree. That was a very cute scene.
Right, and there are times, too, where there was one scene I found very interesting. This was one where Mr. Elton tries to, say to Emma how much he loves her, where she's been trying to put him together with Harriet the whole time. And the way that scene is done, and it's I found it really interesting, It's sort of read in a very modern way, and from what I understand, that is typically played as a comedic scene. But what, maybe it's in the script too, but what the way Autumn de Winter stages it, it's like this very kind of dark, almost kind of scary scene where Elton like flips out when like she rejects him, and the way like he talks about Harriet, how he's like beneath his notice. It's like there's a real modern reading to that, which I kind of appreciated.
Yeah, me too. It really reveals how discriminatory people were back then, or at least how blindly they looked on people, you know, financially lower, or you know, when it comes to their title, lower. And you know, there's racism and such now, but like it's back then, it was way more class division, and at least to a more noticeable degree and a more offensive degree, where the word object or at least them being viewed as such was, you know, was there more. So yeah, it really showed that he just hadn't viewed Harriet really, because she wasn't rich, right?
Right.
But I do want to say Harriet's not unrich. She's like, I don't know. She's a middle class didn't really exist yet. Right. But she was kind of that equivalent. I feel like if she was straight up poor, he wouldn't have even talked with her, you know? Yeah. And you view him too, because he's kind of quirky and fun. So you view him in a good way, and that kind of fully cancels out your view of him in a good way. Cause that's, that's how common it was. Regular people believed that sort of, sexist thing, or I guess that's more a classist.
Right.
But like you said, I thought that was a really good job of kind of showing that.
There is a real, cynicism about that classism in the text, and maybe that's where some people are getting turned off, some people who like the album, because the way it frames Frank Churchill as well, as kind of like this kind of D-bag figure who's like kind of waiting for his aunt to die so he can marry this woman who his aunt would consider lower class, Jane Fairfax, and the way that's played too, it's this very like, I can't believe he did that, where it's like, I think in that time period, it'd be kind of like, that's a smooth move, waiting for the aunt to kick it so that, you can just do whatever you want.
Yeah. And, I was feeling the reality show vibes during that part, because I've been watching them, and I was like, uh-oh, scandalous. But, I liked it. And it showed that there was drama back then, right? There was drama.
Right. There's a feeling in the background of some of those scenes where it's like, you know what? A lot of these people are kind of pricks.
Oh yeah. Well, they're all the higher class, right? The one scene where they're all having a picnic together and Emma makes the one really rude joke. I really liked that scene because that really showed how important, I guess, etiquette was, and how just one little joke can really, really push you down that ladder of etiquette and where you are in the class realm.
That is such a great scene because it's been played throughout the film, because the character she kind of insults is Miss Bates, and it had been played like through like the first three quarters of the film to that point, that Mrs. Bates is this kind of annoyance every time she kind of turns up. It's the way it's played is like she's the nosy neighbor from the sitcom, where she kind of knocks on the window and like, hello, how are you? And Emma, you hear Emma do this heavy sigh. Yeah, it is played like that. And then there's just this one turn, and it feels like kind of a mic drop where Emma says something kind of tart, not necessarily deeply insulting, but it's kind of tart, and everything sort of deflates, and the whole picnic breaks up for this like one sort of offhand comment.
And then it goes Johnny Flint George Knightley, and then he talks about how she's
right,
like, her husband I think is passed or something, she's poor and she's going to keep getting more and more poor, right? So just more information about how class worked back then, right? A wife, their husband dies, right? They're gonna lose more and more. They might not maintain being rich, right?
Right. And struggle. And it's drawn very clear that you have Mr. Weston, who, despite being an older man with a grown-up son, very easily is able to remarry and marry this much younger woman who was Emma's governess, and that kind of thing would not be possible for someone like Miss Bates. Like, Miss Bates isn't gonna pick up a new husband, be it an older man or even a younger man.
Hey, we don't know that, but yeah, well, I know what you mean.
In modern times, maybe there's quite the cottage industry for that, if certain online websites are to be believed. But back in the day, and there's a lot of this stuff going on in the movie, which is really, really great. I thought it was a lot of fun. It was beautiful to watch. Some of the individual performances were really great, and I will second your endorsement of Bill Nighy as well. He was a joy.
Really great in this. Spot on for the Mr. Woodhouse role. Mm-hmm, I thought the pacing was good. I thought every scene was at the right amount of time. I don't think anything went along too long. Did you get any kind of feeling of being dragged along too much?
No, not really. No, I, 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 It was pretty well paced, and I like that. I like, knowing not to over. I mean, it's a little over 2 hours long, but it does not. It still feels pretty breezy.
Yeah, yeah, and it's just 2 hours on the dot, which is that's not bad for a period piece.
No. Well, speaking of going on too long, we have reached that time to say goodbye. But Peter, where can people find you on the internet?
As per usual, good old fashioned, Mr. Towerack, YouTube and Twitter. Yeah. Oh, and if anybody's on Screen Rants, my partner Mackie's T just writes for it, so maybe check out some of that.
Oh, really?
Oh. Yeah. She just did one on the BDSM guy in Pulp Fiction, and Quentin Tarantino's comment about how he wanted to make a spinoff about him. Yeah. Yes. So anybody, Max's Tejas, screenrant.com. Yeah, that's it for me.
And that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it. And if you want to listen to it again, you can find it on our website at endcreditsradioshow.com. Download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean or through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. Meanwhile, I will be back here on CFRU Thursday at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Sources Guelph, and that is with my co-host there, Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can check out my political site at guelphpolitico.ca. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. We will be back here next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits, and we will see you then. Thank you.